Dr. Jeffries Leonard earned a doctorate of philosophy and psychology from Howard University and a master of science from North Carolina Central University. Dr. Jeffries Leonard possesses a wealth of professional experience in public health areas, including expertise in minority health and behavioral health programs, policies, and legislation. She serves as Deputy Director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Center for Substance Abuse Treatment at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. She's currently president of one of the nation's oldest and largest women's volunteer service organizations, the Lynx Incorporated. They're dedicated to enriching, sustaining, and ensuring the cultural and economic survival of African Americans and other persons of African ancestry. It is comprised of 15,000 professional women of color and 288 chapters across the United States, the Commonwealth, the Bahamas, and the United Kingdom. Each year, members of the organization, business and civic leaders, educators, doctors, lawyers, elected officials, and activists contribute more than 1 million documented hours of community service to this country. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Jeffries Leonard. Dr. Jeffries Leonard, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad to be here. And how are you, Chancellor Robinson?
I am doing great now that you're here. I've been looking forward to this. I tried to reach out to you and so many times to get you on the show because of all the outstanding things that you're doing. So we're glad to have you on Future Focus now. Glad you could join us. I can tell you there are so many people in Winston-Salem that are excited about the fact that you are on the show. So welcome, welcome, welcome. We began these shows, Kimberly. I'm going to call you Kimberly. We began these shows really reaching out to our guests in this time of COVID-19. And we really want to know how are you doing? How's the family? How are things going for you?
Well, first of all, I do want to say how excited I am to be here on Future Focus now. How thrilled I am that my Winston-Salem community, I actually have family in Winston-Salem because you know I'm a North Carolina native. And my Winston-Salem family, my Link sisters in the Winston-Salem chapter, and just really, really excited to be here with you, one of my earliest mentors and advisors. And because of this age of COVID, like you said, it has allowed us to be able to reach out and touch in ways that we've not been able to do before. And so I think that has been one of the benefits. This pandemic has really challenged all of us, but I think that some of us are coming out of it with some renewed appreciation. So as a family, we have two sons. Our oldest, Victor, is in New York and doing well. And our youngest, Alexander, we had to literally go. My mom and the dog and I had to literally go and pick him up from New York from school in the middle of his freshman year. So he's adjusting. His grades were good. He finished up. He's now a rising sophomore. And we are waiting to see what happens. But Steve and I's empty nest was changed up a little bit. And so we are just happy that everyone is healthy. My mom is still in North Carolina, so you know, we're doing like everyone else, taking it one day at a time and just trying to stay safe, healthy, and sane.
We're great. And I'm glad to know that you're still hanging with mom. That's always a good sign to see that. So full disclosure to everybody, we know each other. Kim and I know each other from past lives. And that's why I'm so proud of you. So glad to have you on the show because we do know each other, right?
We do. And I'm so proud of you because all that you've done. So as you said, in full disclosure, Chancellor Robinson, Dr. Robinson Elwood was my advisor, my major advisor and my academic chair at North Carolina Central University, where I got my master's in psychology. And so I had not only the pleasure of being his student, I had the pleasure of working with him on the research that really did help formulate and provide the basis of a lot of what I have done today and the career that I have now. And truly, I think that well, you know, I'll say you a visionary, because, you know, we were doing work on social stressors and racial justice and how that impacted us from a psychophysiological perspective. And this is all of the things that we're seeing now. And all that you have done in your career, I'm so very proud of you. You and my mom share a very important honor. You both are have been recipients of the Order of the Longleaf Pine. And for those of you who don't know that, that is the highest civilian honor in North Carolina. So,
I don't know. We had some background noise that was happening. Oh. Are we okay?
So your chancellor is quite the rock star, and I think that you know, just the foundation that you laid and the opportunity to work with you at North Carolina Central and be your student, where you introduced a lot of things that were really forward thinking, has just really allowed me to be able to do some of the things that I have done, that I'm doing now.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And I appreciate the kind words that you have just said about the work that you and I did together. I mean, part of the work that we did at North Carolina Central University was really involving students. I wanted to hear from students. I wanted to have student input. I wanted students to be a part of the program of research that we implemented. And you were certainly one of those great students. And I could tell very early on that you were going to go on and do really, really great things. So thank you for full disclosure and sharing that with our listening and our watching audience tonight. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, your career and the beginnings of your career. You mentioned getting your master's degree from North Carolina Central University, but you got your undergraduate degree from Fayetteville State University. So big shout out to Fayetteville State and the Broncos. Also big shout out to North Carolina Central University Eagles. And we also tonight have an opportunity to give a big shout out to the Howard Bisons. So in the house, HBCUs in the house. Talk to us a little bit about setting the stage. How is it that you happen to go to an HBCU, and what was that experience like for you?
I started my undergraduate at North Carolina at UNC Chapel Hill, and went ahead and went back home. And my mom, who is a graduate of Houston, well, at the time it was Samuel Houston, now it's Houston Tillotson, thought that probably what do they call them now? PWI was not the best fit for me. And she said, I think that you should look at an HBCU. And in fact, when I was, it's very interesting, when I was at Carolina, there was a visiting professor from Central at the time who said the same thing to me. And so I decided that I would stay. And I went to Fayetteville State University, and it was a very different kind of environment. You know, students need different things. It was very nurturing. I found that there were professors that certainly had an interest in my success. And in fact, that was my first entree into research with Dr. John Chambers. He received his first research grant when I was at Fayetteville State, and he was my psychology professor. And he asked me if I would be interested in working with him on this particular research grant. We were doing research on biofeedback and hypertension. And I said, yes, okay, sure. And that was really the catalyst for this love of research. And from there, looking at what I wanted to do from a career standpoint, I wanted to continue in my psychology, in the psychology field. And didn't want to be too far from home, and decided that I would go to North Carolina Central and we had, you know, we had friends who were professors at Central, and we had friends who were graduates of Central, and so I thought that would be a really good fit, and it was. I had the opportunity to not only work with you, but meet wonderful friends and had wonderful research opportunities. I don't know if you remember, but one of the internships I had was working over at Duke with Norman Anderson, doing quite a bit of psychophysiological work over with Dr. Anderson. And those foundations were the things that made me decide that I thought I wanted to continue in an environment that was nurturing, where there were a lot of students of African descent, and we were focused on issues that were specific to people of African descent. And from there, you know, at that point, you want to continue with the research that you're doing. And Dr. Jules Harrell at Howard was doing very similar research. And I think you had said, you know, this is what's happening at Howard. You might want to look at that, because we had a very good research foundation, as you said. You really did engage students. We were very integral in the work that you were doing. And we had a real hand in that work, and not only implementing, but helping to shape. I mean, I remember the meetings we had as research assistants and research associates, and those were what I realize now, but didn't realize at the time, you really were shaping professionals to be able to think critically, to be able to look at research from a world view and a world perspective. And I know that was the kind of work that I wanted to continue. And so going to Howard was a continuation of that. And it allowed me to even broaden that base and go into a setting where, again, looking at people who look like me, who engaged in work that was focused on our community and had an impact on our community, and who were concerned and focused on you from a nurturing standpoint. So the experiences were wonderful. I ended up doing my postdoc at the Howard University Cancer Center also, and that was kind of the foray into the public health arena that I started. But the experiences at three HBCUs for me really did solidify the fact that these are schools that we have to have, and we have to sustain, and we have to ensure their survival, because they serve a purpose for our communities. Not to say that there are any issues with other schools, but for many of us, that is the kind of environment that we need. That is the kind of environment that allows us to thrive. And that's the kind of environment that allows us to really be able to use that as a catalyst for success. And that was my experience being able to go, having the privilege of attending three fantastic HBCUs.
That's an amazing story. I mean, when you think about all the mentors that you've had, and you mentioned Dr. Norman Vanderson, certainly a good friend of mine, and he has appeared on Future Focus Now. We had him on the show early, back a few months ago, and so I was excited about that. You mentioned John Chambers, Jules Harrell. I mean, certainly great, great individuals who mentor students, and to have that kind of experience is I think is amazing. And thank you for sharing that. I had forgotten about all of those folks that you work with throughout the year. So that's been an incredible, incredible kind of experience. Why did you decide to go to Howard beyond the, like Jules Harrell and some other folks? What attracted you to getting your doctorate from Howard University?
Well, first of all, of course, Howard's reputation is so stellar. To be able to go to Howard, to be able to continue the type of research that we were doing in that kind of environment, and to work with Dr. Harrell was an extension of working with Dr. Chambers and then you. It was almost a natural trajectory to be in Washington, D.C. and to be able to be in that kind of lab, to work on those kinds of studies. When I got to Howard, the work that Dr. Harrell was doing was taking the work that we did even further around looking at racial stressors and how they impacted our physiological well-being, those psychosocial stresses that we encounter every day, but don't even realize at the time. And don't forget, this was a long time ago. So what we know now really was based on a lot of the work that we did, from Federal State to Central to Howard over the years, because some of these things that I'm saying, many of you all will say, well, yeah, of course. But at the time, we had not had, we were doing the work to validate these things that we felt very strongly, but needed the scientific evidence to be able to say. And so to be able to document that our physical health was integrally tied to the kinds of stress and to be able to do research to show that not only do people of African descent have the stressors that everyone else has, we also have this added piece, this racial stressor, this systematic racism that we are seeing erupt now as a part of the that added stress and how that impacts our health. I mean, it was cutting edge, and it was very exciting. We did fantastic work there. We published. We took this work to, I know you know, ABSci, other research areas. And then Dr. Harrell was the one who said, what we're doing here from a psychological standpoint is very important, but some of these things have public health implications, and introduced me to Lucille Adams Campbell. And that's when I started my postdoc at Howard University Cancer Center in cardiovascular and cancer epidemiology. And that's where we were able to take it even further, but working in communities right around that campus to really look at these issues of race and health. It was truly eye-opening, and it was something that I probably would not have been able to do in any other setting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear you really kind of bring that back and talk about that. I've had a number of guests on the show, and we've talked about this whole notion of the pandemic and how it has kind of shined a bright light on health disparities in this country, as if we didn't know that. And I constantly tell folks that, you know, we've been involved in this for 30, 40 years thinking about that. People are just now beginning to kind of understand health disparities and looking at minority health, and that's important. I will share with you in terms of the students at North Carolina Central University and how important they are for me. And I'll show you something that people who will be listening to the podcast won't be able to see it. But this is a plaque that they gave to me when I was leaving North Carolina Central, and it has about 50 students' names on here. And these are 50 students that studied with me and did their master's degree with me. And so when I was going through and researching something, particularly around the links, and we'll get to that in a moment, and I saw that you were the 17th president of Links Incorporated. And I saw that who the president was, and I said, I must know this individual. So I had to go to the plaque, Kimberly, to see the name on here and your name. So that's how I ended up contacting your organization and trying to get in contact with you about the work that we did together back at NCCU.
Yeah. Well, you know, we gave you that plaque as you were leaving Central to go on and do even more exciting things. And now here you are at the helm of Winston-Salem State, one of our great HBCUs, to take that vision. I mean, when you think about, and when you said 40 years ago, yeah, I guess it was. I guess it has been that long. But at the time, The things that we were looking at, like you said, it was new and it was different. I mean, we worked in substance abuse. You worked in substance abuse. You set up the center at Central, and people really weren't looking at substance abuse as a behavioral health issue at the time. It was something to be stigmatized, and as I said, it was very cutting edge. And those were the things that really did lay that foundation. When you talk about what behavioral health looks like now for our students, I mean, some of this history, everything was very segmented back then. You had mental health, you had, how we manage psychology and our clinical sciences, and then these other issues of substance use. It was very different. It was looked at very different. And to be able to start what you started when you started the integration of that as a behavioral health concept at Central, especially in our communities. And when we talk about some of these things that we see, these things that we're seeing now, and how we integrate them, not only from a behavioral health standpoint, but how they have been laid this whole racial issue and racial justice is laid on top of that. That's why you see some of the things that we're seeing. But back then, it was very cutting edge. Because now when we talk about it, I'm sure those who are listening are like, well, yeah, you were laying that foundation to start that work and start this conversation in a very different way. And that's very important to note. And each level, each stage, you built on that. And so that plaque was when we said bye, because you said, I have other things to do now. I've done all I can here, and it's time for me to go and do something.
Thanks once again for that. But talk to students who might be interested in going into psychology. I know, you know, you were a psychology major, you have a PhD in psychology. Talk to the students at Winston-Salem State University and other HBCUs. One, the importance of HBCUs, and also the importance of psychology.
I'm going to start with the importance of psychology, because I didn't start off as a psychology major. Like a lot of us, we have these ideas of who we should be and how we should move forward. And sometimes those ideas are not necessarily framed by us. Sometimes those ideas are framed by others. And so I went on off to Carolina thinking I was going to be a zoology major and be a physician. This is a woman now who can't even stand the sight of blood. So that was something. But I took my first psychology class as an elective, and then something just clicked. It was like, this is almost the missing piece. It explains a lot, this whole concept of mind and behavior and how we look at it. And so it was something that I was so excited to be a part of. And took that with me, and was pleased to be able to not only major in psychology, but build a career. Now I'm going to blame Dr. Robinson for me not being a clinician, because the research piece was so exciting to be able to be in the lab, to be able to do that research, to be able to come up with different ideas on you know, how can we test this, and this is a theory, and what about this. Was much more exciting to me than being a clinician at the time. And so that's when I kind of moved my career path into the research, because once that research bug hit me, starting with that very first research grant at Federal State, and then expanding on that in such a broad way. And then again, like I said, I think I blame a lot of this on you, because went over and set and worked very closely with Norman Anderson on the work they were doing, and saw a totally different side of psychophysiological research. The research piece was just was what I wanted to do, and then went to Howard to be able to continue. And my degree was in personality and with a minor in developmental. And as I said, my postdoc led me to in the public health arena. But I say that because very often when we look at these careers in psychology, at least at the time, we thought that they were very narrow. And what I have found is that they're not narrow at all. There's so many aspects to psychology. And I think that in my day, I'm 57, we'll be 58. So, you know, we did look at things somewhat narrowly. But now the whole concept of psychology, the background, the foundation it lays for you, allows you to do anything. I mean, you are being trained to understand how people think, how people process, what the underlying mechanisms of those processes are, how we make decisions, how we manage our health, our mental health, how that's tied. So there's so many aspects. Almost everything you see is really tied to psychology, even the concept of why we buy what we buy. I mean, all of those things are based as from a psychological standpoint. And so anyone who has a degree in psychology, who has that foundation in psychology, you can take that anywhere. My psychology degree has served me so well in so many different ways. Because of that level of understanding that it has afforded me to have, and to be able to have that research, understanding the this concept of social justice and stress and physiological, the physiological correlation, being able to, as I said, the process to understand the theories of how the mind-body connection, forensic psychology. So for me, someone who has the career in psychology has the world opened up to them. You know, your graduate degrees are important. It allows you to do postdocs. I mean, you can go into other things, but that foundation really does serve you well. In your professional life, using those skills and those tools. For me, I would advise anyone to go into the field of psychology and to be able to be very creative in how you are able to use the degree and the skills that you receive from that. I think that it is such a rewarding arena and discipline to be able to engage.
And you've had some really great positions. And so tell us about what are you doing now? I mean, because I read that you have your own consulting firm, and what is that like, and what kinds of things are you doing right now?
Well, as I said, being able to use this psychology degree has really afforded me some wonderful opportunities. Once I started in my postdoc and was able to get that public health training on top of the psychological piece. At that point, I went and worked with the Myotech Corporation and did some really exciting things. This is when we first started looking at the integration of HIV, AIDS, and substance abuse. And so the foundation that we had for the research that we did at the time really provided the foundation to work with the federal government as they started providing funds and grants and programs to support community-based organizations as they integrated their substance abuse programs as a part of HIV/AIDS programs. Very often, you know, they were communities were seeing a correlation between HIV/AIDS and substance abuse. The government said, yes, we see this as a viable area, and we want to provide funds for organizations to address this. My role in at Myotech when I first started was really working with these organizations to make sure that their programs were developed appropriately, they were asking the right questions, they were looking at things the right way, they were integrating these programs appropriately, looking at, and when we talk about substance use, we're not just talking about alcohol, we're talking about tobacco, we're talking about other substances, how those substances impact treatment, how treatment is approached, how prevention is approached, and the psychological processing of what those prevention messages look like, what treatment processes will work for which type of person. All of those things were things that we were doing that I was able to do, tapping into my psychology background. I actually was able to broaden my work at Myotech and ended up becoming a vice president, and then left Myotech to become the chief operating officer of the Department of Health for the District of Columbia. Now, I definitely was able to use my psychology background there and my programmatic background there because the work we did was so very broad. And when you talk about the Department of Health, there are many, many aspects and elements to the Department of Health. And so that was another very exciting and rewarding position. And then I continued to work independently and work with companies and organizations setting up their programs, doing their evaluation, strategic planning, all with that base around the public health and the psychology-based approach to the work that they were doing. I did was the deputy director at the the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment at SAMHSA, and then went back to do my own work. And in my own work, what I found as a consultant and my own consulting company, it's been very broad. I've worked with managed care organization to work with them around putting programs in place for pregnant women. You know, what kinds of things will get, you know, if you look at some of the data, the United States have some of the worst rates for women, Black women, in terms of mortality and morbidity for pregnant women. Well, what kind of programs work for what kind of women? Working with them as a consultant to do that, strategic planning, working with public and private entities around strategic planning, helping to set up substance abuse facilities. All of those things are some of the things that I have been able to touch on as I have done my own business.
I mean, it sounds great. Who are some of the organizations that you work with? I know I had a conversation with you a while back and you said you were doing some work for Howard University. Are there other companies that you work with as well?
I've been able to work with Howard University. I've been able to work, like I said, with a number of managed care organizations. I've worked with the federal government on some of the agencies in the federal government. I've actually been able to work with a number of community-based organizations in the African American community. So it's been very broad. I've worked with private organizations to put evaluations in place and programs in place. So it's been very broad.
Right.
And there's never a dull day.
Really great experiences across the board. Let's segue into the fact that you are the 17th national president of Lynx Incorporated. How cool is that? And what do you do? Do you wake up? Do you pinch yourself? Do you say, I'm president of this prestigious organization? How are you handling all this national president?
I do wake up and pinch myself. It is truly, truly an honor to be able to serve as the 17th national president of the Lynx Incorporated. As you said, we're an organization. We actually have over 16,000 members. We hit that milestone, so I'm very proud of that. And we do have 288 chapters. And we are in 41 states, the Commonwealth of the Bahamas, the District of Columbia, and the United Kingdom. The women in the Lynx Incorporated are truly, truly amazing women. It's an organization of leaders. We have members of Congress, CEOs of major corporations, mayors of cities. You name it, it runs the gamut. And to be able to be the leader, I just was reelected to my second term and I'm so very honored and grateful. So I do wake up and pinch myself every day. I've been a Lynx for 24 years now. And the work that we do, this organization has been in existence for 74 years. We'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary in 2021. And we were founded on the tenets of friendship and service. Our two founders, Sarah Strickland Scott and Margaret Rosedale Hawkins, were friends. And they wanted to address some of the issues in their communities as friends. And so we have continued that vision of our two founders, and we continue to serve as friends. We are an organization that has logged over 1 million hours of service every year. I'm just so very proud of the work that we do. We have amazing chapters, we have amazing members, and it is absolutely an honor to be able to say that, you know, there's only 74 years, there've only been 17 women who've held this role, and to be one of them, it really is just beyond something that, you know, it's truly an honor.
No, I mean, it's beyond that. It's absolutely incredible. And I asked you, did you pinch yourself? Because as I'm reading about your organization and I'm looking at past presidents, I mean, there's some incredible women who have been president of the Lynx Incorporated. Helen G. Edmonds.
That's right, from Durham,
North Carolina. Helen G. Edmonds. I'm talking about a legend historian.
Yes.
I took classes in the Edmonds Classroom Building on the campus of North Carolina Central University. She was president, and now you're president.
I know. I mean, to even be amongst these luminaries It is really surreal because, you know, Helen Edmonds is a legend in Durham, North Carolina. You know, Glenda Newell Harris. You know, I mean, all of our 16 presidents that have preceded me are truly legendary, and each one of them has made, you know, a critical contribution to where we are as an organization. We are truly, you know, focused on those things. We do our work across what we program areas that we call facets. The first is services to youth. Our focus, we focus on programs that impact and address our children. That's under which our HBCU program lies. We have the arts to make sure that we're bringing issues around, you know, addressing issues of the arts and bringing the arts to our community. National trends and services, where we address national issues of the day. International trends and services, where I know our Winston-Salem chapter has worked very closely with Winston-Salem State around a lot of international work. And then we have
Winston-Salem, the Winston-Salem chapter is the best chapter in your organization. I want the entire world to know that it is made up of some of the most incredible women around. It is the top chapter in the Lynx Incorporated. There are women who I know who are in the organization. Two of them keep me straight almost every day. Letitia Walls and Kathy Stitz, shout out to them because I have to work with them and I have to see them. And if I don't give them a shout out, I'll be in trouble. But there's so many others. I did that. And I'm going to get in trouble because I actually gave them a shout out. There are so many women in Winston-Salem, dynamic, wonderful leaders, part of this organization. So you can be proud of the Winston-Salem chapter.
I'm very proud of the Winston-Salem chapter. They're an award-winning chapter. They have won awards in Winston-Salem for their childhood obesity program. They've done a lot of things, I know, with Winston-Salem State University, and they continue to do. So I'm very proud of them as a chapter. I know that the work that they've done, and I know that they are continuing to really impact our, one of our tagline is LinkedIn Friendship, Connected in Service. They truly are, all of our members are. You know, as I was inducted 24 years ago, what I've seen every year of my service is that we are an organization that is truly not only impactful from a national level, we have four areas. Our eastern area is our first area, our southern area, in which you all are a part of, the Winston-Salem chapter, our central area, and our western area, and then our chapters. So we're impactful at every level. We've given five legacy grants, what we call legacy grants, which are $1 million grants to organizations, starting with the United Negro College Fund. So we gave $1 million to the United Negro College Fund. We gave $1 million to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And I know you remember Kimba Smith and her story. We were very instrumental in helping to raise our voice to help get her pardon. We gave $1 million to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee. There's a room there, a community room with our name on it. We gave $1 million to the Smithsonian African American Museum of African American History and Culture. And then recently, our most recent legacy grant was to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital to study sickle cell. So focusing on children of African descent. So we really are impactful. In my administration, our efforts have been broad but narrow, social justice issues. Our organization has been very influential and instrumental in some of the policies that you've seen. Like I said, we have Link Sisters in Congress. And we were one of the first organizations to sign on to the Crown Act, which is the bills that states are signing on to allow women to wear their hair in natural states and not have any impact around that, not have any residual impact around that. So we have been, our police and justice, Black Lives Matter, of course, we were doing that. And we have partnered with the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. The president, C.J. Davis, is in the Durham chapter. And we have put together a peace program, police engagement and community education, to really address even before we got to this point. And so the work that we do is timely and it's impactful. We have a signature program called HeartLinks. Where we're looking at issues of cardiovascular, because heart disease is the number one killer of Black women. We just approved our newest signature program around STEM, because I know, as you know, as a college president, that STEM careers are so important to Black women, and we have to get them into those careers very early. So this is a program where we are really moving and in introducing STEM to young children so they can get into these careers and understand them early. We have been working with voting. I mean, our partners are NAACP, When We All Vote, Stacey Abrams Fair Count, Stacey Abrams is a link. And we have been really working around voter suppression, registration, and we want to make sure that we get everyone to the polls. The census, we have a partnership with the Census Bureau to make sure that people are counted. I mean, I could go on and on, but we really are trying to ensure that we use these 16,000 voices in a way that we're going to impact change.
I mean, you really do in so many ways. I mean, you're talking about using those voices to bring about change and have an influence and impact on these communities, and the links certainly do that. You mentioned your programs, your legacy grant programs. These are amazing programs. And during the local chapter, for example, last year, the local chapter here in Winston-Salem presented Winston-Salem State University with a major, major donation and contribution around scholarships. And so that's so very important. How do you do all the work? I mean, you talk about being in so many different spaces and impacting so many areas. How do you do that organizationally? And I'm really concerned I want to talk a little bit about the work that you're doing with St. Jude's, because I think it's some powerful work. How do you make those determinations about where you want to have your influence and impact, and what's next? I mean, you started out with one or two major legacy grants, which are quite frankly amazing. St. Jude's, I think, was your last one. Tell us a little bit about St. Jude's, and then talk to me a little bit what's next.
Well, St. Jude is really, so every 4 years we do one grant of scale, and in the last administration we decided that St. Jude would be the legacy grant because of the work they were doing around sickle cell and how that is impacting our communities. One of the things that is important for us as we identify is how we're able to work as a partner. For us, these kinds of relationships are critical partnerships. And so we don't want to just provide funds. We want to be able to be partners. I think we had a role in framing that sickle cell piece. We know that St. Jude is developing an app. You know, one of the things about St. Jude that's very unique is that they work with these children as they come into their facility. Children don't pay anything, but at a certain point they age out, and you know, with something like with a disease like sickle cell, that is a disease that really has to be managed. And so what they're developing with support of our legacy grant is an app for those young people who are aging out of St. Jude to be able to help them manage their sickle cell through their behavioral changes as they age out of St. Jude. They're also doing research in Africa, looking at some genetic predispositions and some genomes. So that's also very important, because those are the things that kind of tell the tale around, you know, how sickle cell mutates and is manifested. And so we're very proud of that. What's next for our legacy grant? I'm not sure. We'll see. We go through a vetting process, and as an organization, we determine what the next legacy grant will be. One of the things that I will say is that you ask where we decide to focus. While it seems like a lot, everything is very integrated. And one of the things that, you know, as we talk about a lot of these things, There are a lot of common threads. They're impacting our communities. Sometimes we're even working with the same people around some of these different issues. So it allows you to be able to have that touch in our communities, because those are the communities in which we need to be. And when we talk about making an impact, I want to talk a little bit about HBCUs. We have a number of Link sisters who are presidents of HBCUs, the product of three HBCUs. To be able to support and sustain and ensure the survival of our HBCUs is so very important to not only my administration, but historically it has been. And it's just as you see the Winston-Salem chapter supporting Winston-Salem State, many of our local chapters support their local HBCUs. Each of our areas has a focus on HBCUs. So we raise money, we support the students at the HBCUs. We just had a webinar where we had three HBCU presidents who were linked: Benedict College, Houston-Tillotson, and Tennessee State. Each of those phenomenal presidents are linked. And then we had students.
I know all three very well.
I know you do. And so they really talked about how they have had to manage during this pandemic, what we can do to support the HBCUs. And then we had students come and talk about, you know, how we could support them. But from an organizational perspective, some of the things that I have been trying to do is to be able to leverage some of the relationships and the partnerships we have. So we have been, as we have partnerships with the American Cancer Society, we have partnerships with UNICEF, we have a phenomenal partnership with M Financial, which is our economic empowerment program. Each of these has agreed through this partnership to be able to provide internships, fellowships, feet in the door, seat at the table for HBCU students. The Magnet program, our partner with M Financial, they're working with to bring younger links in, and they're looking at internships for students specifically from HBCUs to get into the financial arena. And so what we're trying to do in this administration is to ensure a seat at the table, a foot in the door, where our students may not necessarily always have that. And so that is literally written into our partnerships and agreements. If we do this, then we want to ensure that, you know, at least X number of HBCU students have opportunities in these types of fellowships. So we're looking at very unique things to be able to ensure that we've got those relationships are working to support the mission and the vision of our HBCUs.
Oh, I mean, well said and well done and powerful. And I can hear it in your voice, the commitment to HBCUs. And I want to thank you for that. Those of us who are presidents and chancellors of HBCUs, we appreciate that kind of commitment. And we appreciate the partnership that we have with the links. So you've been in the organization for 24 years. Tell us about the links today. How do people see the links? I mean, how are you growing? How are you changing? If you look at the organization, where are you today?
We are very different than where we started in 1949. Our tenets of friendship and service has not changed. But as with every organization, and we've gone through a life cycle. Our founders were not, you know, were younger. And then we kind of moved towards some older, you know, a demographic that may have been a little older. And now we're moving back to really a more intergenerational organization. When you look at who we are, what you see is a group of dynamic women from ages 21 to 101. And we have really moved to focus on what the intergenerational needs are of our members, but also really focused on the social justice issues of our community. We've always done that. But what I think is that people are really, because of the times that we're in, because these truly are unprecedented times, we have really looked to leverage our partnerships so that we can be more impactful in our communities. Throughout this pandemic, we have brought partners to the table and have hosted, you know, webinars in terms of COVID. We have a dynamic COVID task force, and we had our Surgeon General as one of our very first webinars to address issues of this pandemic. Pandemic While Black, we've tapped into our partners at the NAACP, our National Medical Association partner, our National Dental Association partner, our mentoring partner. We're partners with National Cares Mentoring. Like I said, we're partners with UNICEF. All of these partnerships have allowed us to be able to be nimble, to be able to address those issues that are of unique importance to our community. And what I feel is that our not only do our members see that, but our external community sees that. And so I think that, you know, while some things change, some things stay the same. We're friends who do service, and that service is impactful. But in any day and age, and with any organization, with any entity, you know, you have to be nimble to change to be able to address those needs. Here we are on this Zoom call, and our members have moved to be able to work with our communities in ways they've never had to do before, and they've done it. I mean, I think if you look on any social media, you'll see our chapters again. I know you see it with the Winston-Salem chapter, doing things virtually, working with the students they work with virtually, providing meals and support to those who are supporting in the pandemic, but keeping on the service that is needed in a way that allows us to be able to touch our communities through the technology that we have available to us. So we're nimble, we are socially conscious, and we're using that our voice to address and be able to be the voice for those who cannot. And we are continuing to move based on the tenets of friendship and service.
Mm. You've been in the organization for 24 years. Why did you want to become president, and what are you most proudest of?
When I became a link, my oldest son was 6 days old, and I was excited to be able to be a part of this organization that my mother was a part of, because I grew up watching so many wonderful women who were members of this organization truly making a difference. And as I continue to serve and work and serve at different levels, I thought that I could make a difference with the skills and the perspectives that I brought to the table. I have wonderful mentors in the links. I've had wonderful relationships in the links, and so I just thought that, you know, this would be an opportunity for me to be able to bring my skills to the table to help continue to move, and on the foundation of those who have come before me, continue to move this organization in ways that we may not have moved before. We just, I think maybe 3 weeks ago, just convened our very first virtual national assembly. To be able to do that, to make history in that way, I never would have dreamed that I would be sitting in this space in the middle of a pandemic, having to do that with our 16,000. We had 7,000 members register for that assembly. And so we were able to do that. And so for me, some of the thing that I am most proud of is being a president of 16,000 women and ensuring the care and nurturing of the legacy of this organization. Regardless of the challenges that we face, but to be able to meet it head on, just as we did with the virtual assembly, and to ensure that we continue within the vein that our founders laid, the foundation they laid for us. And so that's what I'm most proud of, to be able to continue to build on that legacy while ensuring that we are able to move with these times and keeping this organization moving based on those tenets.
Oh, fantastic. And you are how many years in existence?
74. We'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary on November the 9th, 2021.
Now, that's a big anniversary. I mean, what are the major plans for that?
I can't tell you that right now. you have to wait and see.
You have to wait and see for that. Kimberly, I mean, this has really been great. Thanks for spending some time with us on on a Tuesday evening, on a Tuesday night, and for Future Focus Now, we're glad to have you. Like I told you before, I was looking forward to having you on the show. I got to get you to come to West Salem State.
Hopefully, I would love to.
Hopefully when we can get back to business and we can move about more freely than we are now, and we can begin to hold events and things of that nature, I want you to come to Western Salem.
I look forward to it. And I'm so very honored to be a guest on your show, Chancellor Robinson. It has been such a pleasure. And again, I want to just shout out to all of my amazing Link sisters who have joined tonight. My chapter, the Arlington chapter, you know, I love you so much. And I just want to thank you. I think my mom is watching. She told me to tell you hi.
That's so, right.
So I just, it's really been an honor. And thank you for all that you're doing to not only support our Winston-Salem chapter, but to serve as the chancellor of Winston-Salem State in such an impactful, powerful way.
Thank you so much. And thank you everybody for joining us tonight on another episode, another edition of Future Focus Now. This has been a great conversation. Come back next week and see who we have on the show. But once again, thanks to Kimberly for being a part of this great show tonight. And good night, everyone. And stay safe and be healthy. And we'll see you next week on another Future Focus Now. Good night.
Good night.